Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about artisan butcher shops that are popping up across Wisconsin. They seem to be going hand in hand with the farm to table movement. And we see this trend toward pasture-based farms, free-range poultry, and knowing the farmer who raised your meat. And we'll find out how this meat is produced as we explore craft butchery with two guests. Jeff Sindelar, one of those guests, a UW Extension meat specialist. He works out of the UW-Madison Meat Science Lab. Jeff Sindelar, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also with us today, Dan Fox. Dan is the owner and chef at Heritage Tavern and Fox Heritage Farms in Madison and Willow Creek Farms in Prairie du Sac. Dan Fox, welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. And as you listen to these two experts talk, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Do you prefer to get your meat from what we might call a nose-to-tail butcher? Are you a farmer who wants to switch to more pasture-raised or grassland livestock? Questions about the cuts of meat and what choices you should make when you go to the meat counter. I know that can be a daunting task if you haven't had a whole lot of experience in that area. So there's a lot of things we can talk about with these two guys today, and I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, we've certainly seen the influence of the farm-to-table movement. I think you see it at farmers' markets, certainly at a restaurant like yours, Dan. People eating locally grown food. How is this movement spreading to meat production, do you think? Jeff, maybe start with you.
Sure. So this movement, it's very popular with the meat industry. And it's really interesting to kind of dissect that question a little bit, because the meat and poultry industry is very front and center, very involved with the local foods movement, right? So we can travel out to across the state to one of the several hundred meat and poultry plants, many of them being very small volume, and we can talk to someone and ask, where did this cut of meat come from? And more times than not, they can give you the exact origin. They can tell you where they purchased the animal and who was involved with the conversion of that live animal into a foodstuff, meat, or in some cases poultry, and then how that product was manufactured. Interestingly enough, the local food movement in the meats industry has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And it actually really predates kind of the modern, local foods movement that we've been seeing in the past decade or so. These places have been businesses and have been places that you can go to learn about your products, really since the day these businesses have been open.
Well, I was thinking about my dad worked for Jacobson's Custom Slaughtering, and it was one of those operations where the farmers brought in their animals to be processed, and customers came in from all over. They knew the farmers, and they knew the products, and my dad as a butcher knew the customers and what they kind of wanted, and that was going on, when I was a little kid for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, how did you get involved in all of this, Dan Fox?
Well, it's interesting. I'm a kid from the northwest suburbs of Chicago,
yeah.
So this this conversation kind of started a little bit later on in my career when I started culinary. Farm to table really started as the United States, and honing in on what comes locally from the U.S. Really, when I moved out to Wisconsin just over 10 years ago, and shopping the farmers market, Dane County Farmers Market, and getting into conversations with farmers, that's when my education truly started, as far as truly knowing where your food come from, what the animals are eating, what the farmers are going through every day to produce the products that are hitting our restaurants, and then that stemming to actually educating our customers. When I got into farming, I wasn't I'm not a farmer by trade, so I kind of feel like I took the backward angle to it.
But sort of backed into it.
Yeah, it's you know, it started as a hobby, and kind of hobby gone wild. But at this point in time, I feel it's unfortunate that we've lost you know, touch with a lot of that history, especially as a younger person. Mm-hmm. And I feel very grateful that, you know, there's still a lot of folks around to learn from. And it's almost gone a little too far in the direction of young kids not establishing or finding, having a way to establish that education, a way to establish a respect for, you know, the farmer down the road and what they're going through to actually produce your product to hit the local butcher shop or your restaurants.
How would you define craft butchery or artisanal meat production? That's a it's an interesting term.
To me, craft butchery or artisanal meat production really is just slowing down the process.
Okay.
It's really not looking at an angle of mass producing just so every chicken breast, boneless, skinless chicken breast can be 5 ounces, like pumping out, like, you know, quote unquote a factory, and really diving into that whole animal utilization, and you know, realizing that there are many parts of the animal beyond just a tenderloin, beyond just a, you know, 6 ounce steak that can be, you know, very, very, very tasty. You can get, there's a lot of value in. It can really go a lot further than just opening up a bag and seizing a piece of meat and putting it on the stove.
Yeah. I can remember watching my dad give advice on how to prepare various cuts of meats to customers who would come into the store. And so there was that little education part of it that seemed to work pretty darn well.
Yeah, that education piece of it is really, I think, something that we kind of overlooked or lost a little bit, at least if I think in the younger generation. So slowing down the process is has been the biggest piece for me as far as being a craft butcher.
Yeah, and in terms of, Jeff, in terms of grass-fed or pasture-raised, you know, that whole process, what does that mean in today's world?
Grass-fed, pasture-raised, these are all terms which are acknowledged by several different entities, for sure consumers, some farmers and ranchers and live animal producers, the regulatory agencies such as state and federal regulatory bodies, state and federal governments, as well as you know, meat and poultry processors, and then the consortium of the meat industry, so distributors, wholesalers, retailers, restaurants, grocery stores, supermarkets, and so forth. What that is and what that means is really, really oftentimes debatable and can be very controversial, right? Uh-huh. It's simply boiled down to providing products in which there are consumer demands and doing so in a way that is as standardized as possible. And that little piece, that standardized as possible, is where you start having some controversy and some potentially polarizing.
So what's the controversy?
Well, the controversy is several fold, right? So what is the definition of organic or natural or grass-fed or grain-fed? And who is responsible for ensuring that that definition is meet, that definition is met? Other controversies include which is better from a taste, from a flavor, from an eating experience. Another one might be which is better from a sustainability or a carbon footprint or an agricultural aspect or how we should be raising animals or the social environment or impact that animal agriculture has. So there's many components that can contribute to lots and lots of great discussion.
Yeah, I certainly could see that. And I saw something online. Somebody asked the question, well, why when I go to a nice restaurant, I have a steak and I can never seem to be able to replicate that in my own home. And the person who answered said, well, that's because when you go to one of those restaurants, they're using, in the case of beef, for example, they're using prime beef, which is highly marbled, contains essentially a higher proportion of fat, and that affects the taste pretty much, doesn't it, Dan Fox?
Yeah, in my opinion, fat is flavor. It's there's a lot to do there. And yeah, when you have a all grass-fed diet, it typically promotes a much leaner animal. So as a chef, I'm always focused on flavor. Flavor mm-hmm. first. And sustainability definitely goes hand in hand with that. So we're not always on the exact route of it has to be grass-fed, it has to be organic. We're more concerned it does its part. And mm-hmm. that it's doing its part, you know, we're wanting, you know, we need to have an amazing experience for our customers. So without that flavor piece, it really, we miss that connection. But we put a lot of time and energy into our sourcing, and even going into raising animals ourselves to achieve that.
Yeah. So do you go out and meet with farmers and?
Absolutely. Yeah. We go out and meet with farmers, and we've taken it, you know, a step further. And I've been raising animals for just over 8 years now, and now we've built a network of Amish farmers in the local area to raise animals for us. And beyond that, we have. It's a big conversation with anyone who brings animals to us, as far as the diets, the sustainability of the animal, the sustainability of their farm, and how that correlates as far as, you know, into our business.
Yeah. Jeff, you were going to add to that?
I was just going to ask Dan if you could just share his trade secrets on what makes a great steak, how you do it, how you pull it off.
Well, I think we've kind of hit the nail. It starts with the meat.
Yeah.
It 100% starts with the quality of the product that we're using.
Yeah, and you work a lot with pork, do you not?
Yeah, I would consider myself on the side of heritage pork farmer. We raise primarily Berkshire pigs, which is an old English breed.
Yeah,
it's very well known for its quality of meat. It's deep red meat, has a little more gamey flavor profile, and its ability to have that intermuscular marbling. And we have many different heritage breeds that we raise, and it's actually it's amazing to see, you know, break down those pigs and how it, you know, can translate breed and diet dependence into the quality.
Talking today with Jeff Sindel, our UW Extension meat scientist at the UW-Madison Meat Science Lab, and Dan Fox, owner and chef of Heritage Tavern and Fox Heritage Farms in Madison, and Willow Creek Farms in Prairie du Sac. Questions for them? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Kate Archer Kent, our on-air producer today. Dave Potratz, our engineer, on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today. Larry Mueller here talking artisanal meat production and craft butchery with our two guests, Jeff Sindelar from the University of Wisconsin Meat Science Lab and Dan Fox, owner of and chef at Heritage Tavern and Fox Heritage Farms in Madison and Willow Creek Farms in Prairie du Sac. Well, what do you want to know about locally own butcher shops? Do you prefer to get your meat from maybe a nose-to-tail butcher? Or maybe you're a farmer who wants to switch to more pasture-raised or grass-fed livestock? Challenges there? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Arlene in New Berlin up with a question for your comment. Hi, Arlene. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry, and thank you for having this show. I'm really interested in where you can get certain things, but I'll give you a little synopsis. My mother was born in Austria, and she came to this country and then in the 40s when she got married. We used to go to a grocery store in West Dallas. He was Slovenian, and he did his own cutting up and everything. The one thing I know that my mother used to make is a good chicken soup, but you have to have a stewing chicken. And if you go in these grocery stores and you look at the chicken, they're all stripped, and the chickens, whole chickens you buy, I wouldn't give that to my dog.
Well,
and I would like to know where I could get a good stewing chicken, because the soup that you make from it is to die for, and it's the best thing for a cold.
There you go.
Yes. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Arlene. Well, let's see. Who wants to try that one, Dan or Jeff?
Well,
Jeff?
I could make a little comment about the scientific side of that question and comment, and there was a really, really great questions and comments. So stewing chickens are older,
yep,
right? So they have more collagen, more connective tissue. And that connective tissue and collagen is really important from a flavor standpoint, for making stews and broths and so forth. It provides a lot more of that flavor. Mm-hmm. And Dan is well versed in understanding that technique for making really great products in his restaurant. But those compounds, those collagen and connective tissue fibers, they've also shown in research to provide human health value. So there are some medicinal type purposes.
So Arlene was kind of, may have been right on when she was talking about that product or that soup or whatever as helpful in a cold. Yeah.
Likely so.
Dan, comment?
She's absolutely right. I go through an older stewing hen every time that we make a full-flavored chicken broth. I'm actually very happy that came up. It's almost something that's lost now.
How do you find them?
I would say if you go to your local butchers, especially more, unfortunately, outside of Madison, they should be able to find older stewing hens for you. And I even think if you do go into places like Metcalf's Market or the Willie Street Co-ops in town, and you ask the butchers behind the counter, I think they're becoming more well-versed on these topics and willing to go outside of their... I know I get asked from the butchers at Willie Street Co-op and Metcalf's where our products are at, about things just like that.
Okay, there we go. John in Oconomowoc, thanks for...
Oh.
Are you driving your combine right now?
That is correct, sir.
Well,
that's
good.
Correct. I'm calling two things. First of all, hats off to your guests for recognizing that all aspects of agriculture make a contribution. And I really like the comments about various entities doing their part, whether they're grass-fed or conventional or organic. That's great. Thank you for recognizing that. But second of all, I am a dairy producer in Oconomowoc, and I read recently in some culinary magazines about aged Holstein beef, meaning beef from old Holstein cows or old dairy cows, and how it's becoming sort of a trend in upscale restaurants. Is there any truth to this, and is this a market that could be developed?
Oh, well, let's go to Dan Fox first.
You're kind of letting one of our secrets out. Yeah, I do. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is becoming a trend. I think it's. I saw that's kind of starting in Las Vegas with a chef, Jose Andreas, was starting to market older Holsteins as far as ribeyes and whatnot. And we very much are starting that now as far as looking at utilization for older animals and finding an outlet for them. And we've actually talked to some of our Amish farmers about crossing Holsteins with Angus and utilizing some of those older breeding stock. But I think you're absolutely right. I do think there's a market for them. I think the trend is starting.
Yeah.
Just barely starting. But.
Yeah. Jeff, any comment?
Yeah. No, this is not a new technology. Applying it to the Holstein breed likely is a newer technology. But aging has been gone on forever. And in fact, aging, every piece of meat that we purchase and consume is aged to some degree. And aging is defined as allowing natural enzymes that are present in meat, and technically they're called calpains and calpostatins, and allowing those enzymes to slowly break down the structure of meat. So they break down that connective tissue and some of those harder parts that make meat tough and chewy. And with time, those enzymes will function, and if given enough time, they will actually create a tenderizing effect. And at a certain point, which is generally about 2 weeks, that tenderizing effect is maximized, and then you continue on with those enzymes attacking proteins and fat and collagen and connective tissue, and by them working on those components, they actually release very unique flavor and aroma compounds. So if you've had a 40-day dry-aged steak or an 60-day dry-aged steak, you'll notice that they have a very different flavor profile, and that's because of the enzymes that are active that are basically digesting and breaking down different flavor compounds. That technology to Holstein beef is really, really a phenomenal idea.
Yeah, and you're going to pay more for that, of course, because if you're going, you don't just set it outside and let it age. It has to be aged in proper temperature conditions and so forth, and that all costs money.
Yeah, especially with that water loss it takes for the concentration of flavor and the trim that ends up, yeah, it is going to cost a little bit more.
Yeah, there we go. John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Ginny in Platteville. Hi, Ginny.
Hi. I was calling with more of a comment. Since they quit marking where the beef comes from or the meat comes from, like Mexico or the United States, I have not purchased meat in a grocery store, and I won't. But I'm fortunate that there are two very good butcher shops near me, but not everyone has that option.
Yeah, that's although I think that's changing a little bit, Jeff.
It is, and to be honest, I'm not exactly sure where things are. It was a program that was initiated. Lots of controversy among producers, you know, ranchers, and governing bodies and associations such as the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the National Pork Board, and the Poultry Council, and so forth. And the challenge was, and still is today, is the value. Does the value exist? Does it help most of the consumers who want to know where their food comes from in a way that it's that actually does so? And because of the intent of the government who initiated that, made that a law for a period of time, it became a very difficult logistical challenge of how do you manage and police this, right? So are animals born in a country, raised in a country, if they spend any time in one country or another, how does all that manage? And then if you think about some of the larger producers that may be harvesting 10,000-15,000 hogs per day, or perhaps 3,000-4,000 cattle per day, and you start doing the math, how you keep track of all of those cuts, the origins of all those cuts. So a carcass all the way to a T-bone steak in a grocery store, it becomes really challenging, and it becomes expensive. And unfortunately, a lot of that cost has to be passed on to the consumers because there's no way to build that into the already slim markets that some of the larger slaughterhouses have to incur.
Ginny, thank you so much. Mark in Milwaukee, it's your turn.
Hi, gentlemen. I want to say thank you for the advice and the programming, and I'm calling in about dry aging meats. I have a Kingsford steak ager. And I'm calling about the difference between a ribeye, a rib roast, and a primal cut ribeye, and which you prefer for dry aging. Thank you.
All right. So, ribeye, primal cut ribeye, and what was the other one?
Rib roast.
Rib roast. Those are the three.
I think... for me, I think it's the first question, or the part of the question I would like to start with is the dry aging piece, and I always like to dry age out of a primal cut and then start backing away from there.
And when you're talking about dry aging, what does that really mean?
Well, Jeff kind of hit that just a minute ago, where you're actually, I'm sitting next to a scientist, it's more or less, for me, it's you're putting the cut of meat in an environment where it concentrates flavor, there's some water loss going on, and it starts breaking down those connective tissues and tenderizing the meat.
So that is the process, and there's not a wet aging process, is there? Or is there a wet aging process?
There is. There are two types of aging, dry aging and wet aging. wet aging happens every day. So once a carcass or primals are fabricated, right, or cut, packaged, sent to a grocery store or supermarket,
they're aging.
They're aging just by the definition of being in an environment where the enzymes can do their work. Dry aging happens when, or wet aging happens when that process occurs in a vacuum package or bag.
Okay.
Dry aging happens when you take that bag out, take that bag off, and allow it to
hang
in an environment that you control the conditions, which are primarily the temperature and the relative humidity, and time, of course.
So what's the, if you're going to dry age a rib roast or a ribeye or a primal cut ribeye, what's the best? Mark's asking, which one of those is going to come out best?
Well, I always go for a utilization standpoint, since I'm very much looking from a business perspective. We'll start out more with that primal piece or larger piece, because there's going to be, depending on how long you dry age, there's going to be a significant amount of trim that takes place, depending if there's mold development on the outside or any kind of dryness or hardening. When you start cutting it down to a smaller piece, your utilization of that muscle is going to dwindle, obviously.
Yeah.
So once you go to a primal piece, a rib roast is more or less something that just comes out of the loin of the animal, when you can have bone in or bone off rib roast, and then from there you'd cut that rib roast down into an actual ribeye.
Yeah.
So to summarize, if you're wet aging, doesn't matter. Steaks are fine, but larger pieces are okay. If you're dry aging, the recommendation would be to use the largest pieces possible, because you're going to have to trim some of the outside off.
There we go. There you go, Mark. Thanks so much for calling. Steve in Boyd, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hey, guys. Thanks for doing the show. First of all, and this kind of fits in really good with this little hobby farm that my wife and I started just about 3 years ago. We both work full time and bought this little 40-acre place. I have a good friend of mine who got me started with cattle and hogs. So what we raise is they're Scottish Highland crossed with Red Angus, and they're all grass-fed. We don't give them any grain. Most of the time on pasture, and we bale our own hay here. And it's, I guess it would be considered organic. It's not certified organic. But anyway, that's the beef that we raise. And then we started out with trying out the Berkshire hogs. So we had a sow, and we raised a couple litters, and I really liked it. But with the goal to kind of transition, you know, from working our full-time jobs to kind of pull more money from this, so maybe one or both of us in the future could do this kind of full-time. But the issue that we're finding is, starting out, as far as selling our products, you know, the family and friends, they're used to the supermarket price, and we wound up losing quite a bit of money selling the pork. And just based on, we got a local feed mill, we feed them a pretty good mix of feed, but we can't ever come out with that. So I was just wondering if there was any marketing tips or people I should be looking to sell this stuff to.
Those are good points, Stephen. One of the things that I wanted to bring up anyway, because there is a price difference on this Jeff Sindelar.
Oh yeah, there absolutely is, and I. Your story can be echoed across the state, in fact, across the country, especially for people that are just getting started out. It's really hard to establish a market, and it's really difficult to convey the cost of these products to consumers. And just as you know, this is such a common example of economics, right? So we all want cheap food, and we want to pay very little for a lot. And we have this structure in the U.S., like with fast food restaurants, where we have a really cheap offerings for food. We go into supermarkets, we find meat, pork chops, steaks, and so forth that are at a fairly competitive price point. We start moving more towards the organic, natural, niche, artisan, and we see those products, those prices go up. And it's a very, very simple economic equation. It's how efficient the model is. So if you want to make more money, raise a lot more animals, and have a large enough market with clients and customers that you can offer the lower prices. And if you aren't able to do that, you must be able to show that there's value in what you're selling. You know the animal from the animals from the time that they are born or you acquire them, and there are just certain input costs that are really challenging to work through in very small operations.
So you need to kind of, and you probably have this, although you probably use all your own product, Dan.
Thankfully we do have a pretty significant outlet through our catering company, Heritage Catering, and a restaurant, Heritage Tavern. But we equally have had this challenge as coming from the farming end of it. The advice that I was given and the path that I was shown is really trying to, first of all, establish your market. Where do you want that direct marketing? And if it's direct marketing to restaurants, restaurants definitely have the ability to mark those products up and find utilization. And then the next piece would be education to your customers, and that transparency of either inviting people out to your farm, doing farm tours, or painting that picture and bringing that story to your customers. And really expressing to them and educating them on why the product is more expensive, the time and energy that you put into it. That's a tough one, and it definitely takes a lot of energy, and a lot of farmers don't want to do that direct marketing. And we've been trying to kind of fill that void ourselves.
Yeah, so really getting to know your, getting out there, telling your story, to figuring out who are we going to serve here, be it restaurants and or customers that are just the average person who wants to buy something, and then educating them on why your product stands out from the product they can get at the store.
Yes.
That's basically it. Pork came up here. Judy from Stevens Point called to ask if there's any hope for fatter pork in the future. Her pork chops get so dry.
Geez, I sure hope so. I'm trying to build a career on that. So, we started marketing, the other red meat, as far as pork is concerned, trying to get away from the stereotype of kind of what happened in the 70s of, remarketing pork after people were scared of disease or if it was healthy to eat. And then, of course, there goes all the fat marbling as far as when you got into conventional raising. But as we, I stated earlier, fat is definitely flavor. We are a big proponent of bringing that back. It's one day at a time.
Yeah. Why do, just from a cooking side of things, if you've got whatever pork chop Judy's got, how does she best prepare that pork chop so it isn't dry?
The easiest thing I would say is brining. I'm a huge supporter of brining any leaner cuts, especially pork or poultry. My brine recipe is a gallon of water, half cup of salt, and a quarter cup of sugar. And you bring that solution up to a boil. You let it cool down in the cooler, down to 40 degrees. You pour that over your pork chop. You let it sit for 6 to 24 hours. And that when it takes the salt and the sugar into the pork chop, it really helps kind of keep that cut of meat moist.
Yep. And Dan is explaining the artisanal process of what a lot of pork and poultry in supermarkets and grocery stores already utilizes, which is an enhancement or injection with a solution, small amount of water, salt, and then a couple other functional ingredients to help prevent that. I'd also throw out that for many years, kind of driven by a concern about trichina, pork has notoriously been overcooked. Recent years, a couple of years ago, USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, came out with cooking guidelines, new cooking guidelines for pork, explaining that 145 degrees internal temperature resulted in completely safe pork. And that would be that would go a long ways in helping keep pork from drying out.
So a good meat thermometer helps, no doubt about it. Well, Tom in Wanakee, your turn. Hi, Tom.
I have a question regarding when it was mentioned about grazing in, you know, the grass-fed. How do we know, or how do you know, that the grasses or the fields, the what they're eating out there is clean, is good, that the fields have not been had pesticides or manure or other things on them? I guess that's the basic question.
Okay.
That's a great question. I'll throw my comments, which won't be a lot because I'm not extremely experienced in this area, but I do know that not only MR culture but production agriculture, crop agriculture has come a long ways, and there's definitely resources such as extension specialists in crop and soil scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who can give you specific and accurate, highly accurate responses, but in general. You know, just like animal agriculture, production agriculture, crop agriculture has also seen a lot more stringent regulations. So the requirement of pesticide applicators licenses and approved ingredients that can be sold and banning of other ingredients. So that is kind of a skirting around your direct question. But it's very unlikely that there are really any concerns about insecticides, herbicides, pesticides.
And it does go back a little bit, I think, to how we started this by, you know, talking about artisan meat production. If you go to a local shop and you learn who are the farmers and how do these farmers raise their animals. I think, Dan, that gives you a little more comfort, I think.
You're absolutely right. It's knowing your farmer, it's knowing where your food comes from, and that level of, if someone's not willing to be transparent with you, and if you're asked to go out to their farm, or you're asked the butcher where the animal comes from, and you're not getting a straight answer, not a straight response, I think that would be the first level of defense there. It's and that's kind of the whole idea behind the local food movements, is just really knowing the point A to B of where your food's coming from.
Well, there's a lot we haven't touched on here that we could be touching on, but we are out of time. I want to thank Jeff and Dan. Thank you both very much. Perhaps we could have you back and do this again. It'd be great to do it.
Yeah, the time went by so quick.
Yeah. 45 minutes goes pretty fast around here. Thank you again so much. And we'll have them back and we'll do this again with them. Jeff Sindelar, UW Extension Meat Scientist, works out of the UW-Madison Meat Science Lab. And Dan Fox, he owns and is chef for Heritage Tavern and Fox Heritage Farms in Madison and Willow Creek Farms in Prairie du Sac. We'll have them back and we will do this again. So what we're going to do next is hop in our canoe or kayak and take a little trip with Darren Bush. That next here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.